Thank you all. Thanks for having me. Please be seated. Thanks for coming to say hello. What I thought I'd do is share some thoughts with you and then answer questions for a while. Before I do, I want to thank Randy and the Loudoun County Chamber of Commerce for setting this up. I appreciate you all coming. I've got something to say, and I hope you do as well, as we have a conversation about how to make sure this economy of ours continues to stay robust and strong so people can find work and realize their dreams. Before I talk about the economy, I do want to say Laura sends her regrets. She came home last night about 12:45. She just came back from Africa, where she and my daughter Barbara and Connie Rice went to witness the swearing in of the first elected woman president of the Congo of Africa. Great trip. She said it was an inspiring inauguration. Just wish she had tiptoed in a little quieter. She's doing great. And you know, one of the best things about the presidency is how close our family has remained and how wonderful a wife and mother she is. American people get to see that. Speaking about families, Chuck Kuhn's family is pretty remarkable. Turns out his mother works for him. That's the opposite in my family. I need a little advice on how to restructure the chain of command. But I love being here in a place where a guy who had a dream at age 17 years old. That's how Chuck was when he started to act on his entrepreneurial instincts. He said, if I work hard, and if I'm smart, and if I figure out what the market wants, I can build something that I call my own. And 23 years later, we're standing, obviously, in what has become a very successful business enterprise. Successful because he is thriving and expanding. Successful because he has provided people a good place to make a living. And so I want to thank you, Chuck, for being a great entrepreneur. I want to thank the folks who work here for setting this deal up. I'm here to talk about how to make sure that America is the place where the entrepreneur can succeed. That's what we're really here to discuss, isn't it? And it's a wonderful place to have that discussion. Before we get there, I want to thank the Attorney General, Bob McDonnell of the State of Virginia, the Commonwealth of Virginia, for being here.
Appreciate you.
He's sitting next. He's an old governor buddy of mine, Bill Graves. He was the governor of Kansas during the time I was the governor of Texas. And I used to remind him he made a really smart move when he married a woman from Texas. Still married, aren't you? Good move. It's the best deal that's ever happened to you. Great to see you. Bill is the president and CEO of the American Trucking Association. I want to thank all the other state and local officials who are here, but most importantly, I want to thank the small business owners who are here. I was interested to find out that Loudoun County is the home of 10,000 small businesses, 80% of which have got 10 employees or less. Pretty strong. Thank you. Probably one of the reasons why you're growing so fast is that people realize this is a good place to take risk. And that's really the role of government, when you think about it. I like to tell people, the role of government is not to try to create wealth. That's not the role of government. Well, sure, the role of government is to help the poor, and help the elderly with medicine, but it's not to try to create overall wealth. The role of government is to create an environment in which people are willing to risk capital, to take risk. An environment in which people are willing to work to realize their dreams, just like here at this trucking company. That's the fundamental policy principle on which I'm basing my decisions as Congress to think about how to make sure the economic growth that is now prevalent in America continues. We've got a robust economy, but it wasn't necessarily going to be that way. When you think about what we've been through, it kind of helps point to what good policy may be. We've been through a stock market correction. We've been through corporate scandals, which affected the confidence of people. We have been through a terrorist attack, which hurt our economy. We have been through war. We've had significant natural disasters, all of which could have sent us into a downward spiral had we not put good policy in place. We've overcome these issues, and I believe one of the main reasons why is because we let people keep more of their own money. I asked Congress for tax relief. I believe strongly that if the entrepreneurs of America have more money in their pocket, they will use it to expand their businesses. I believe very strongly that if a consumer has more money in their pocket, they will demand extra goods and services, and when somebody demands an extra good and service in a market economy, somebody's going to produce it to meet that demand. And so I went to Congress and said, look, we got problems. Let's be aggressive about how we address it. Let's cut the taxes on everybody. I remember the debate said only some people should have tax cuts. So we lower rates for everybody. If you're going to have tax relief, everybody who pays taxes ought to get relief. You ought not to try to play favorites. Who gets it and who doesn't get it. We mitigated the damage of the marriage penalty. I always thought it was a little contradictory to have a tax code that discouraged marriage. Seems like to me we ought to encourage marriage in this country, and the tax code ought to encourage that. We lowered the tax on dividends and capital gains because we want to encourage investment. We put the death tax on the road to extinction. The death tax is a punitive tax for small businesses and farmers and ranchers. It's a tax you pay. You know, you pay income tax, making money, you're paying tax to the government, that's fine. And then you die, and your heirs get to pay it all over again. And that doesn't seem fair. It seems like to me that you want a tax system that encourages families to be able to a family member to pass their assets on to whomever they choose without the government making it impossible to do so. So the death tax was put on its way to extinction. I said put on its way to extinction. The problem is, you know, the way the law was written, it's coming back in life in 2011, which is going to make some interesting estate issues, particularly in 2010. We increased the child credit, or we wanted to help families who got children. One of the things that's really important for Congress to recognize is that most new jobs in America are created by small businesses. If you're interested in job growth, then you gotta be thinking about where's the engine for growth? And it's the small business owner. 70% of new jobs in America are created by small business owners and entrepreneurs. Many small businesses pay tax at the income tax, individual income tax level. Sole proprietorships, subchapter S. These structures in which people are able to grow their businesses, but they're advantageous to the owners of the business, and can be paid individual income tax rates. And so when you hear me talking about we cut taxes on individuals, you also got to recognize we cut taxes on small businesses. And if you want there to be job creation to offset the trauma that our economy has been through, our country has been through, then it makes sense to say to the job creators, get a little more money for you in your pocket. We also encouraged investment. You might remember we made it tax advantageous to increase investment in plant equipment if you're a small business owner. All the policies that that I'm describing to you were aimed at saying to the small business sector, we understand your importance. Here's how to help you grow. The other thing that you've got to understand in Washington is that you hear a lot of debate about the deficit, and it's an important debate, don't get me wrong. But in my judgment, the best way to solve the deficit is to grow the economy, not run up your taxes. There's a myth in Washington. They say, all we got to do is just raise the taxes a little bit, and we'll solve the deficit. No, that's not how it works. They're going to run up your taxes, but they're going to find new ways to spend the money and not solve the deficit. That's how Washington works. The best way, it seems like, to me to solve the deficit is to keep pro-growth tax policies in place and do something on the spending side. So I'm working with Congress, and I want to thank the Speaker and the leader for supporting and passing lean budgets. I say lean because we've got one aspect of our budget that is not going to be lean, and that is anytime we've got a kid in harm's way, he or she is going to have the best equipment, best training, best possible pay. That's what we owe the families of our military. But on non-security discretionary spending, we slowed it down every year I've been in office, and actually the non-security discretionary spending is lower in 06 than it was in 05. We've actually reduced non-security discretionary spending. The issue of the budget is mandatory spending. That means you don't have discretion. It's fixed by formula. Two biggest programs you face, of course, are mandatory spending increases are Medicare and Social Security. And we're going to have to do something about it. And a lot of folks in Washington don't want to do anything about it. It's too hard politically. I want to share some thoughts with you about my view of too hard politically. I think we're supposed to do the hard things politically. I think the job of a president and jobs of leaders in Congress from both political parties should confront problems now and not pass them on to future generations. And we got a problem with Social Security and Medicare, I tell you why. We got a bunch of baby boomers like me getting ready to retire. Matter of fact, I'm 62 years old in the year 2008. It's a perfect fit. And there are a lot of us. Loving the sense I'm there. We've been promised greater benefits than previous generation. Politician grandfather said, vote for me, I'll make sure your Social Security benefits go faster than the rate of inflation. And as a result of a lot of us retiring and fewer people paying the system, the deal's gone broke. It's hard for me to travel the country and look at hardworking people paying payroll taxes to a system that I know is going broke. It should be hard for Republicans and Democrats to get there as well. And so I just want to assure you that no matter how hard it may seem for some, I'm going to keep talking about it. That's the job of the president, is to remind people of the challenges. There's a long-term deficit issue as a result of a system which is out of balance and out of kilter. We need to do something about it now. We have that obligation. The Senate has a chance, or the House now has a chance to pass a budget bill or appropriations bill, or reconciliation bill that actually starts to cut mandatory spending by making reforms. The deal passed out of the House, passed out of the Senate, and has to go back to the House. And be a good faith gesture. People from both political parties to say, we see we got a problem with mandatory spending. I would start reforming the system for the sake of the future generations of Americans. Things are going well, by the way, in the economy. We had 4.6 million new jobs since April of 2003. What I'm telling you is the tax plan is working, and here's what I can say to you without having to throw some hot air your way. Since April of 2003, 4.6 million new jobs have been created. Not by government, but by entrepreneurs. We had a national unemployment rate of 4.9%. I think it's 2%. 2.7% here in Loudoun County. Think about that. The economy grew at 4.1% in the third quarter. And that's in spite of higher energy prices, and two storms. But think of how robust our economy is. It's growing at 4.1% in the third quarter of this year in the face of storm and high energy prices. That affects your business, doesn't it? Those high energy prices. And yet you're growing. In other words, we've got an economy which is robust. The industry statistic is the manufacturing activity's been up for 31 straight months. We hear a lot of talk about manufacturers, the trouble with manufacturers, and of course there are some trouble, but we've had growth for 31 straight months. Productivity is up. That's a really important statistic for our country because productivity, as a worker becomes more productive, as the workforce is more productive, higher wages follow. That's just a fact of life. You realize that from 1973 to 1995, productivity in America grew at 1.4%. At that rate, the standard of living doubles every 50 years. But today, our productivity is up, average 3.4% over the past 5 years. We're more productive as time goes on. Technology enables our workers to be more productive. Education enables our workers to be more productive. Smart business leaders are constantly trying to figure out how to make their companies more productive. The more productive a workforce is, the faster incomes go up. So what I'm saying is things are going fine. We have more minorities ever before in our country owning their own home. Home ownership is on the rise. And the fundamental question facing us, what do we do to keep it going? What do we do? Well, first thing is Congress needs to make the tax relief permanent. You know, this relief is set to expire. The easy course is, of course, say, well, let's just let it expire. That's a tax increase if the tax relief expires. We hear people say, well, we're not going to make it permanent. What they're telling you is you're going to run up your taxes. That's what they're saying. Failure to make tax relief permanent is a tax raise on the working people and the small businesses in this country. If you're a small business owner, there's got to be certainty in the tax code. Congress needs to put themselves in the shoes of people who are trying to plan. Good business owners, good small business owners don't think, 2 months in advance. They think years in advance. They're making capital schedules. They're thinking about how to grow their company. They're constantly strategizing. Uncertainty in the tax code makes it hard for the small business sector to stay confident and to make investments. And when there's uncertainty, it makes it harder for this economy to show steady growth. So we don't need to make this tax cut permanent so we don't take money out of your pocket. We need to make the tax cuts permanent so there'd be certainty when it comes time for small businesses to plan. I understand there's a problem with health care, and I suspect there'll be question and answer. We'll get questions on health care. One of the biggest problems our small businesses have is an increase in health care. The role of government, in my judgment, is to take care of the poor, the Medicaid, and community health centers. The role of the government, in my judgment, is to take care of the elderly through a Medicare program, which is modern. And by the way, provides choices for our seniors. But I also think the role of government is to encourage a direct relationship between the consumer, the patient, and the provider, the doctor, without a lot of go-betweens. I think that I know that small businesses should be allowed the same affordability of health care that big businesses get by being able to pool across jurisdictional boundaries. Pool your risk. If you're a restaurant owner here in Loudoun County, a restaurant owner in Crawford, like a couple of restaurants here. Not what it would be. No, there's a good one. Coffee shop. Coffee station, excuse me. But they should be allowed to pool their risk across jurisdictional boundaries. In other words, the larger the risk pool, the more employees you're able to get in the risk pool, the easier it is to manage your costs when it comes to health insurance. You can't do that now. And Congress should be allowed to encourage you to be able to pool risk. An interesting product available is called Health Savings Accounts. I strongly urge every small business owner here to look at it. It's It's an innovative product that enables a small business owner and employee to combine, work together to come up with a plan where the employee owns it. So it provides for a high deductible catastrophic plan coupled with tax-free contributions in the plan. Basically gives the consumer control over his or her medical decisions. The plan can grow tax-free, which is an encouragement for people to make wise decisions about how they treat their body. If you have a catastrophic event, the insurance kicks in and covers it. It's portable. If you change jobs, you can take it with you. It's an interesting idea. It certainly stands in stark contrast with the system in which the federal government gets to make the consumer's decisions or tells the providers what they can charge. It's the opposite of federal control. It is patient control. And we need to do a lot on information technology. The healthcare industry is inefficient in that you still got people filing out forms with handwritten notes. And doctors can't write anyway, and it creates a lot of confusion, as you can imagine. We need to have legal reform. I mean, you can't have a legal system, a medical system that's available and affordable when you got your doctors being sued. You realize we got a crisis when it comes to OBGYNs in America. The good docs who have got the great compassionate job of taking care of youngs, they're getting run out of business because of frivolous and junk lawsuits. It makes no sense. When I first came to Washington, I said, this is a state issue. But the problem with all these junk lawsuits is that they cause doctors to practice defensive medicine. In other words, they prescribe more than they should because they're afraid of getting sued. And when you practice defensive medicine, it makes the cost of medicine go up. When you couple that with increasing premiums, it costs us a lot of money at the federal level. I'm talking billions a year as a result of junk lawsuits. And good small business owners have trouble affording health care. Part of the reason why is because of these junk lawsuits. And so I decided this is a national issue that requires a national response. We need medical liability reform in Washington, D.C. so that health care is available and affordable. Laura always says I get too long-winded when I come to one of these bills, so I'm rein her in here. That's something to say. We got to do something about lawsuits in general, not just medical lawsuits. One of the things I hear a lot from small business owners is they're afraid to get sued. We've got a society which is litigious in nature, suing right and left. That makes it hard. That runs up the cost of staying in business. It makes it harder for people to work. Of course, if you have a legitimate lawsuit job, you're having to go. Everybody understands that. It's just these frivolous lawsuits. And we're trying to do some things about it in Washington. We've got class action lawsuit reform passed. We're trying to get an asbestos law reform passed. We've got bankruptcy passed. We've got manufacturer's liability passed when it comes to firearms. I mean, we're making some progress when it comes to lawsuit reform. I heard the Attorney General here that urge the governor and the Commonwealth to pass good lawsuit reform as well. It's a really important issue for the vibrancy of our economy. Now, energy, real quick. We're hooked on foreign source oil. We need to do something about it. Pure and simple. I've got a strong faith in technology being able to lead us away from a hydrocarbon society. It's going to take a while. The federal government has a role to invest in research and development. Envision a day when we're using corn husks, different kind of grasses, to be able to convert it into energy. Down in Brazil, they've got enormous amounts of energy they get from sugar cane. Their automobiles or flex fuel automobiles are able to convert from gasoline to ethanol made by sugar cane on an easy basis. I mean, it's coming. And the role of the federal government is to encourage these new technologies to be able to make us less dependent on foreign sources of oil. We don't have more nuclear power in the United States of America. It's clean, it's renewable, it's safer than it ever was in the past. We need to be thinking about how we can use solar batteries better. There's a lot of things we can be doing. I'm confident that with the right policies and the right incentives, technology will help us diversify away from a hydrocarbon world. But we got plenty of certain kinds of hydrocarbons. We can use coal. I'm also convinced, with the right expenditure of money, that we'll be able to have zero emissions coal-fired plants that will make us less dependent. You realize we've got about 250 years of coal here in America? It seems like to me a wise investment is to figure out how to use that coal in a way that heats your homes, fuels your businesses, and at the same time protects the environment. So we have to think about how to incorporate new technologies to diversify away from foreign sources of energy, not only for economic security, but for national security purposes. I want to talk real quick about trade. I believe it's important to open up markets. I think it's a mistake for this country to go isolationist when it comes to economic policy. You realize we're 5% of the world's population, which means 95% of the rest of them could be customers, so long as we've got a level playing field. My job is to make sure that if you're producing a product, that it has fair access to markets. You ought to treat people, that people ought to treat us just like we treat them. And I'm a strong believer that if the playing field is level, this country can compete with anybody, anytime, anywhere. And if we can, we ought to figure out why not. Competition is good, so long as it's fair competition. And finally, I want to talk about education. As you expand your businesses, as they become, as they change because of technology, you're going to need a workforce that is capable of filling the jobs. We've got to make sure we get education right in the United States. Otherwise, the jobs of the 21st century are going to go somewhere else. This is a competitive world in which we live. There's no way to deny that there's competition in the world. We play like it. We put up foolish short-term economic policies that hurt the small business sector, protectionist policy. But it's a competitive world. And people are going to go to where the skill sets of the labor market are such that they'd be able to produce the products of the 21st century. It's reality. So what do you do about it? Well, first thing you do about it is you make sure your kids at the elementary school get an education. Teach them how to read, write, add, and subtract. The No Child Left Behind Act is a great piece of legislation. I think as small business owners, you understand where I'm coming from. It said you got to measure to determine whether or not you're succeeding. I was concerned when I was the governor of Texas that we had an education system that didn't measure, and therefore we didn't know. And oftentimes when you don't know whether a child can read and write, add, and subtract, it just ends up being shuffled to the system. I believe that we ought to measure. As a matter of fact, we are now measuring as a result of the No Child Left Behind Act. It says we want to determine whether or not you can read at grade level by the third grade, and whether or not you're at grade level with the fourth grade, the fifth grade, and so on. And if not, here's some money to help you make sure your child is up at grade level. You cannot solve a problem until you diagnose the problem. And the No Child Left Behind Act is a diagnostic tool for local school districts. We're not telling you how to run your schools. That's up to you. We didn't design a federal test. We said, you designed an accountability system. And it's working. We have an achievement gap in America that is not right and needs to be closed. We have too many African American kids not reading at grade level they should be. And I say a lot of that is due to just moving kids through without determining early whether or not they've got the skills necessary to read, write, and subtract. We're changing that. The achievement gap is closing. It's a really positive development. I tell you how I know, because we measure. And we solve problems early before it's too late. We got to have the same high standards in high school with an emphasis on math and science. We got to use our community college system to constantly upgrade the skills of people. The job market changes. The easiest thing for society is to have technological change. The hardest thing is to make sure that the education systems are flexible enough to help the job market change with technology. Community colleges is a great asset in our country. They're available, they're affordable, and if they're run right, they have a curriculum that changes with the times. They're not one of these institutions that just stay stuck. They're institutions that are going to change our curriculum to be able to educate people for the jobs which actually exist. That's what we need to do, I'm telling you. So I'm going to go to Congress here pretty soon and call on them. Put economic policy, energy policy, health policy in place that understands that this economy is strong, but we need to do the right things to keep it going. With the centerpiece of our economic policy being the small business in America. Anyway, that's all I got to tell you right now. I'd be glad to answer a few questions.
Yes, sir.
Mr. President, welcome to Loudoun County.
Thank you.
We've got a transportation problem here.
You've got a transportation problem here.
And across Northern Virginia.
Yeah.
Downtime and traffic is loss of productive time for businesses, and it's time away from home and family for individuals. We don't get to use helicopters.
Right. I won't in 3 years either.
How can the federal government help states and localities address the transportation problem?
We passed the highway bills, and it's set. Congress argued about it, argued with them about it, it's a $270 billion-plus bill that is the law for a period of time. And that's up to you to spend the money allocated to you by formula in a wise way. I think it's an issue where federal government's responsibility is clear in law, and that is that we take the gasoline tax and pass it back to you. But we get to decide where the roads go, and probably what it should be. I'm noticing the campaign for governor here, part of the campaign, roads. And that's good. That's the way it should be. People say vote for me and do something about your roads. I hear your problem with your roads, and so you want the decision making about the roads to be here at the lower level. But the federal government's role in highways is pretty well fixed for 5 or 6 years. Yes, sir. Go ahead and yell it out.
Yes, good morning. I'm a CPA here in Loudoun County.
Right.
Prepare a couple hundred tax returns a year. And the IRS does not spend a lot of time auditing. Last administration turned the IRS into a customer service department, and here the last 3 years have been reorganized. There's quite a few people that do not comply, and I really think the IRS needs to get out there and audit, but none of my clients.
Yeah.
Overpass housing boom. I guess my question is the consequences of this great housing boom have increased the cost of housing so much, not only in this area, but throughout the country. It's very difficult for me to envision my kids being able to afford a home, or even the workforce that drives much of our school systems and our police and fire forces. How do you see the federal government helping this workforce housing component be able to afford housing close to where their jobs are?
Markets adjust, and the role of the government is to make sure the market is able to adjust in a way that is not precipitous and disruptive. When you have wage and price controls, for example, in history, it's tended to not allow the market to adjust in a smooth way. Doesn't function properly, and therefore the consequences of government trying to either manage price or demand is very severe. So to answer your question, it's one role of the government is to make sure that markets are given the flexibility to adjust in a way that doesn't cause major disruption. If houses get too expensive, people stop buying them, which will cause people to adjust their spending habits. Secondly, setting of interest rates affects your business. You'll be happy to hear that the White House doesn't set interest rates. The Federal Reserve Board sets interest rates. I get to name a chairman, I named a good guy, Ben Bernanke. But it's their job to be independent from the political process and look at market forces in all aspects of our economy to determine the interest rate to be set. Say, look at inflation, consumer demand, etc. So to answer your question, I think the simple answer is let the market function properly. Let the market function properly. I guarantee you that your kind of question has been asked throughout the history of home building. Prices for my homes are getting bid up so high that I'm afraid I'm not going to have any consumers for my kids, and yet things cycle. It's just the way it works.
economy should cycle. We just don't want the cycles to be so severe that it's disruptive, so that, you know, you get going out of business, for example, or somebody gets going out of work. Yes, ma'am.
Thank you for coming to Loudoun County, Mr. President. I run a nonprofit that provides health care to the uninsured.
Good.
Something near and dear to your heart, 45 million uninsured people in this country. Of course, Loudoun County is no different. We provide health care free by volunteer physicians who are involved in a nonprofit. And it's a good private-public partnership. You talk about community health centers as being part of the health care delivery system. We, too, are part of the health care delivery system. How do you see your role and the government's role in helping us do what we do when we've discovered recently that we're not going away anytime in the near future?
Yeah. I think there ought to be there are tax incentives to encourage people to contribute to your non-governmental organization. Which is good, because we want more people in the tax code system so they can give to their group or the church, synagogue, or mosque, or somebody whose job it is to help the enforcer get abduction for it. So, secondly, the uninsured, first of all, there's the working uninsured. A lot of them work for small businesses, because small businesses can't afford insurance. Small business owners would like to pay for the insurance, but the cost of medicine is increasing. And I just gave you two prescriptions for that. One is a bunch of prescriptions to help control the cost and enable small businesses to be able to manage the expense. If you stand alone as a small business owner, 10,000 businesses, 80% of which have got 10 employees or less, and you try to buy insurance as an employer of 10 people, it's going to cost you a heck of a lot more than if you try to buy insurance with your 10 people in a pool of 5,000 people. It's just the way insurance works. It's called spreading the risk. There are some in the uninsured world who simply choose not to buy insurance. That would be your bulletproof 22-year-old person. Is that a college? I'm never going to be sick. Nothing ever bad is going to happen. I just don't think I'm going to want any. Health savings account is an interesting opportunity for the young 22-year healthy person who's able to put money aside tax-free and watch that money grow tax-free and take the money out of the health savings account tax-free, coupled with a high deductible catastrophic health plan. In other words, this is a product that will say to those who choose, you know, here's an opportunity for you. You start putting aside $1,000 a year, don't you buy a high deductible policy with a $1,000 deductible, and you put the $1,000 cash, you do, or your employer does, or however you negotiate it, that $1,000 grows. And it can grow to be pretty substantial, particularly as you're a healthy person, over a period of time, tax-free. And all of a sudden, then you've got quite a nest egg. I'm going to call on Congress, by the way, to make these health savings accounts more attractive, more portable, more individualized. There are some who come to our country that don't have any health insurance but work. We've got immigrants coming that can't afford health care. Their employers, the type of job they have is one that doesn't lend itself to health care. That's one way the government can help us, to have community health centers as primary care facilities to deliver health care and take the pressure off the emergency rooms. We're expanding these a lot. My judgment is we're going to use the taxpayers' money to provide health clinics for the poor and the indigent, so that they don't go to where the health care is more expensive, the emergency room, but go to where the health care is, primary health is more manageable. So there's a series of ways to address the issue. But the truth of the matter is, government policy has got to aim at the increasing cost of health care. Part of the issue in Medicare is the projections of healthcare costs going up the way they are. The issue that small business owners face in the short term is increasing premiums. So we need medical liability reform to help address the costs. We need to encourage information technologies, and I'm told that there will be a significant reduction in medical costs as we modernize medicine and bring medicine into the 21st century through the use of information technology.
health savings accounts, encourage consumers to pay attention to price. There needs to be transparency in pricing. Do you realize the medical field is one where you don't do any comparative shopping? When you buy a tile, I presume, for your house, you're out there shopping. You know, say, well, what am I bid? You know, when you buy a pipe or ask, you know, for things you put in a wall, insulation, you're out there bidding price. There's no transparency in pricing in medicine. You don't know whether the guy next door is going to offer a better deal when it comes to some kind of medical procedure. It seems like to me the more transparency in pricing, the more likely it is consumers will have an input into the cost of health care. So these are ways to address the cost of health care. Obviously, as health care costs, the rate of increase is manageable, there'll be less people coming into the city. One of the reasons why the uninsured is going up is because the cost is going up. And so the government needs to address the cost. There is a debate in Washington. Some will say the way to address the cost is to have the federal government be the decider for the consumer and the decider for the provider. And that will be, in my judgment, terrible for this country. And so this is we're talking about a very important and interesting debate. And I'm going to continue pushing policies that address cost and empower the patient and the doctor into a relationship that is not only good for the patient, but also one which I think will affect the you know, the pricing mechanisms and the prices here in the country. Yes, ma'am.
A word of gratitude to you, Mr. President, and your administration.
Even that, really?
Yeah.
About time.
No,
thank you. It's always good to have a plant in every audience, you know?
Well, the timing of this opportunity is uncanny. I want to thank you for your unwavering support of the Veterans Administration. My father spent the last 10 years at the Martinsburg, West Virginia VA, where he was loved and respected and so well cared for. And we buried him 2 weeks ago in Arlington, and it struck me then how strong the promise still is to our veterans and to our wonderful men and women of the service.
Thanks. You know what I thought just when you said that first? Our country's great because we've got a lot of people who've been willing to serve. The really important that we keep an all-volunteer military. And one way you do that is to make sure that people pay them well, because you can pay them, that they're trained well, that their loved ones have got adequate housing on the basis, family life is good. Education system to work on our basis. But also after service, there is a healthcare system that will provide modern healthcare for them. It's so nice for bringing that up. The volunteer army is really an important part of our nation, and it's a really important part of fighting war on terror. Your kids who know the stakes, they saw the attack on September 11th. They have made a conscious decision to swear and to serve the country. And so thanks for bringing that up. I just wanted to share that with you, to tell you that our troops are always on my mind, their families are always on my mind, and it's important to leave a legacy behind of a strong military based upon patriotic Americans saying, I want to serve. I'm stepping up. Nobody's telling me to. I have made the decision to do so. Yes, sir.
Good morning, Mr. President. Thank you for being here. My son is one of those young men. At 18 years old, I hope I don't cry, but he asked
me. I hope you don't too, because I will as well.
Okay. He asked me to take him to the Army recruiter. He didn't drive yet, but he wanted to go to the Army recruiter to join the Army. He's in the National Guard in Christiansburg, Virginia. and he's also with the Virginia Tech Corps of Cadets.
Good, thanks, yeah. I know you're proud of him.
Yes, I am. He sent his best wishes to you.
The old commander-in-chief, that's a smart move.
He and I discussed a question I want to ask you. Most people in this room today are leaders of some type. I'm a leader of an adult education center for Marymount University. And my question to you is, how do you remain upbeat when you're surrounded by the burdens of leadership?
That's my faith in my family and my friends, for starters. I like going home to be with my family. I was teasing about Laura waking me up this morning at 12:45, but I'm glad she did. You know, I take great pride in my little girls. I'm not going to talk about them too much, otherwise these people will look at the newspaper. I'm trying to... Right, Jackson? I'm trying to spare them, because I think that, you know, one of the hardest decisions about going to public life is exposing people you love to, you know, the public nature of public life. I'm proud to tell you that my friends that I knew before I became in public office are still my friends. One of the coolest things to do, not a presidential award, one of the... see if you're paying attention. Things I like to do is to welcome my buddies, and Laura feels the same way. People we grew up with, we both grew up in Midland, Texas. I remember having some of my friends that I went to first grade with, a guy I grew up across the street with, Michael Brocker. They came up to have dinner at the White House, you know, they kind of walk in there. You can imagine what it's like. It's a great honor, you know, awe-inspiring deal. They walk in there and, what are you doing here, Bush? But I really like it. They're my friends. They help me remind So, you know, what's important is what you believe. And it's leaders have got to know the core principle from which you make decisions. And you can't change. A lot of temptation to change and try to make people want to like you. It's not the job of a leader. The job of a leader is to know where he or she wants to lead and know the principles on which you'll make decisions. I take great comfort in having people around me who can walk in my office and tell me what's on their mind. It's part of my job is, I say, what's your job? My job is decision maker. I make a lot of decisions. Obviously, some of which you've seen, and a lot of them you don't. And there are big ones and little ones. But you make a lot of decisions. And if you don't, if you're uncertain about all the facts surrounding the decision, you got to rely upon people. And you then got to create an environment in which people are willing to come in and say, here's what's on my mind. It's important at presidential level, it's important in business. You got to have people comfortable about saying, here's what I think you ought to do, Mr. CEO. You got to listen and have it. I've always believed in the flat organizational chart. I think the worst thing that can happen for decision makers is to get a filtered point of view. And it's pretty hard as president, needless to say. But I've got a group of people around me that are empowered to walk in. You know, Condi Rice, when she walks in, she comes in as a close friend, but as someone who knows that our friendship will be sustained whether she agrees with me or not. Rumsfeld comes in and he's a crusty old guy who's got an opinion, and he tells it. And that's important. That's the way it is throughout the White House. I like to tell people the first decision I made as president was this. A guy called me. I was at the Blair House looking at my inaugural speech. I'm trying to be comfortable with it. Get ready to go. It was a pretty big event coming up. I wanted to make sure that it worked well. He said, Mr. President-elect, what color rug do you want in the Oval Office? I said, man, this is going to be a decision-making experience. What color rug do I want in the Oval Office? He said, no, I'm not kidding you. It turns out presidents design rugs.
or somebody designs them for them. And I said, I don't know anything about rug designing. So I delegated it to Laura. Interestingly enough, the job of a leader is to think strategically. It's important for your businesses, it's important for the country. And so she said, tell me about the rug. And I said, I wanted to say, optimistic person comes here to work every day. This is the strategic thought for the rug. She figured out the colors. It looks like a sun, you know, nice open colors. You walk in that Oval Office, I think you're going to say, just like you know, this guy's optimistic. I'm optimistic. Hey, by the way, you can't leave your company and say, follow me, the world is not going to be good. You're not going to have a lot of employees saying, great, I love working here, you know. It's got to be follow me, the world's going to be better, and I have a plan to do it. And one reason I'm optimistic is because I'm sustained by my faith, family, and friends. I'm also sustained by the fact that I believe strongly in the values of the United States of America. Human rights, human dignity, individuals count. Freedom is the future of the world, and I'm sustained by those beliefs. And thanks for the question. It's an interesting question.
Yeah.
On behalf of the Loudoun County Board of Supervisors, we welcome you.
Thanks. Thanks for having me. You don't look old enough to have gone.
I'm the youngest member.
Yeah, well, is this your board here?
This is Mr. Delgadio, Mr. Snow, Mr. Statton, and Mr. Flynn.
Yeah, you certainly are the youngest. Pretty young guy, too.
And
you're
happy to know we got health savings accounts for our county employees.
Good move.
We pushed it through.
Good move.
But on transportation, one of the solutions that I've been putting forward is telework and expansion of broadband so that people don't get caught in traffic. The Congress is contemplating a revision to the Telecommunication Act of 96 that would essentially shut down the options that states and localities are exploring to get broadband to every business and every home. Mm. And so what is your thought on, as we are falling behind in the world, on delivering broadband to businesses and homes and residents?
I need to find out. It's interesting you said that because I laid out the opposite vision, which was that broadband ought to be available and accessible all throughout the country by a set period of time. I need to make sure I understand what you mean. Congress is trying to unwind that vision because it sounds like you and I should. I believe you. Thank you for the heads up. I'll take a look. You're very smart to. Part of the role of government is to create an environment in which people are willing to risk capital. Broadband expansion is part of creating an environment in which it will make it easier for people to be competitive in this part of the world. It's a brilliant idea. The people are able to do so much more from their home, particularly if you've got the technology capable of carrying information. You're right, I want to make sure you mentioned that. That other nations are ahead of us. True, we're catching up and we'll do better, by the way. But it's part of making sure America is competitive to make sure that we've got broadband available and accessible. One of the interesting questions we're going to have is the last mile issue. And a lot of that hopefully will be changed, or at least more options will be available with the development of a dish that is capable of passing broadband air over the air as opposed to cable. But good question. I need to check and see what you're talking about, and well, thanks for bringing it up. Yes, ma'am.
I was wondering, speaking of the lovely and gracious Laura Bush.
Yes, well.
Who happens to be one of the best first ladies we've had.
Thank you. I thought you might say top two, but you know. If not, I won't tell.
I was just wondering, when we'll see our lovely First Lady run for Senate in the great state of Texas?
Never.
Come on, ask her.
No, I'm not going to ask her. She's never. She's you know what? I think, I'm pretty certain when I married her, she didn't like politics or politicians. And
She's a great lady. She's interested. She's not interested in running for office. She is interested in literacy. We're going to meet with foundations later on today to encourage them to step in where government can't step in New Orleans and in the Gulf Coast. Laura's coming to the meeting. The reason why, she wants to help these schools get their libraries up. She was a school librarian. She believes strongly in literacy. She is, I can remember her, you know, reading to the girls all the time. And I would encourage moms all over the country and dads to sit down and read to your young children over and over and over again. It's one of the lessons she taught me right after she taught me how to read. But she's great. Thank you for bringing her up. She's not going to run for office. Yes, sir.
Mr. President, my wife Sandy and I extend our prayers and our appreciation for all that you're doing in these difficult issues that you're dealing with. I'm a grandfather, about your age, but I have...
you got started earlier.
I started a little earlier, and I'm really proud of my family. You've touched on a lot of issues that really affect us. We have a health care provider, an attorney in the building industry, in the defense industry, and a young grandson who's espousing to the military academies. We are very happy with the foundation that President Reagan and your father laid 23 years ago, about the time the JK started. We're building off of that today. We're living in that security with a good defense system, and we have a strong economy, some of which extends from those days. Do you look forward, and what can I tell my grandchildren? Do you look forward 20, 25 years from now and see a vision of America?
Yeah. I said, I tell people this story a lot. When my dad was 18, he went to fight the Japanese. And some 60 years later, his son sits at the table with the Prime Minister of Japan to help keep the peace. Someday, I firmly believe that leaders in the broader Middle East will be duly elected and will be sitting down with future American presidents to keep the peace. So part of the vision for your children and grandchildren is to understand history and the power of democracy and freedom and liberty to change enemies into allies. And I talk about a lot in my speeches, laying the foundation of peace. And I firmly believe that what we're doing today is laying the foundation of peace. I know that some say democracy can't take hold in parts of the world. You're wasting your time, Mr. President. I strongly disagree with that. The natural rights of men and women, that's part of our founding, says that inherent in every soul, I believe implanted by a higher being, is the desire to live in freedom, no matter the color of your skin or the religion you embrace. And so part of the vision is to lay that foundation of peace by believing and acting on the principles that cause our own existence to be, and on principles and values that have proven over time to yield the peace. Think about Europe. It's hard for some of us to think about Europe, because Europe didn't really affect our lives, did it much. But if you look back over the recent history of the United States and the world, two world wars started in Europe. And today, Europe is whole, free, and at peace because of democracy, in my judgment. The Far East. And the reason this is important is because we're in an ideological struggle. The enemy which attacked us on September the 11th was not just acting out of anger, although they were, not acting out of hate, although I believe their hearts are hateful, but they're acting based upon an ideology. The best way to make sure the American people understand what happens when their ideology takes hold is to think about life in Afghanistan under the Taliban. If you're a young girl in Afghanistan under the Taliban, you have no chance for success, you have no chance for education. If your mother speaks out in the public square, you get whipped. She can get whipped. These people have a vision that is the opposite of America. Their vision is, here is my view of religion, and if you don't agree with me, you're in trouble. Our belief is that what matters is your view of religion. You can choose. The great freedom in America is the ability to choose your religion, to be religious or not religious. We're equally American. Jew, Muslim, Christian, we're all equally American in this country. That's the opposite of what these people think. They have got a strategy. They got a goal, which is to spread this vision throughout the world, starting in the broader Middle East. Like I say, it's to go from Spain to Indonesia to establish their vision, a caliphate with their point of view. These are ideologues. And so you defeat an ideology with a better ideology. If there's no competition, if there's a vacuum, if there's poverty, hunger and anxiety, and a vacuum's created because of that, this ideology will move in. However, there's a competing ideology available. If there's an alternative for people to choose from, then all of a sudden their march to their vision is impeded in the long run. And democracy is the alternative. Liberty. It's not American-style democracy. Japan didn't say, let's just look like America. Japan said, we'll have a democracy that suits our needs. That's the way democracies develop. They develop with history and culture of the people in mind. And so what you're seeing in Iraq is twofold. One, a commitment to defeat an enemy overseas so they don't hit us again, coupled with allowing these Iraqis to live a dream of being free. And it's tough work. It's tough because some of the enemy are these ideologues that are trying to stop the march of freedom. Some of them are people that are irritated because Saddam's not in power. They liked it being that, the power of the. Some of them are wondering whether or not the Sunni rejectionists are wondering whether or not they'll even have a say in the future government, and therefore are nervous given the dynamics of the demographics. But some of them are people there intent upon destroying the advance of democracy because they understand, they know that they can't compete with liberty. And the amazing thing that happened last year that I hope this gives me hope is that millions of Iraqis made a choice. You know, they defied terrorists. We see it. The terrorists that have weapons of our TV screens. These people are cold-blooded killers, I'm telling you. I mean, as you know, I mean to tell you that. And what they're trying to do is they're trying to drive us out before democracy can take hold, because they understand, I haven't talked to them, so I'm not exactly sure. I put words in somebody's mind. I would suspect that deep in their soul, they understand they can't compete. Their ideology cannot compete with liberty. And so to answer your question, foreign policy is a long answer, but it's an important question. The president's got to be thinking down the road. We've got a short-term battle we're going to win, but there's a long-term struggle as well. It's an ideological struggle. At home, I think the two things that I would like to be remembered for, and one is promoting ownership. I want people to own something. I want people owning their own small business. I want people owning their own homes. I think people ought to be allowed to own their own health care account and make decisions for what's best for them in their own settings. I know a vibrant Social Security system is one in which people are able to take some of their own money if they so choose and put it in a personal savings account so they get a better rate of return on their own money than the government can get to the Social Security Trust. But more importantly, I want people owning something. I'll never forget going to a Mississippi automobile manufacturing plant. And there's a lot of floor workers there, you know. And I said, how many of you own 401ks? This, needless to say, was a very diverse audience. So 95% of the hands went up. Men, women, black, white. And I said, how does it feel to own your own assets? See, one of the problems we've had that showed that we found out in Orleans is not, there wasn't a lot of, we take some things we take for granted, like the generations passing assets from one generation to the next. just didn't happen in the African American community. It should. We ought to encourage. We take it for granted, don't we? Some of us do. When you pass the house on, all these people that own their own homes, why don't they have checking accounts? And yet, one of the things we ought to encourage is systems, is reforms that enable somebody to own something so they can pass it on to their child. That's part of creating stability, healthy families, strength. So I want to be known as an ownership, and I also want to be known as the person that kept the de Tocqueville vision for America alive. Tocqueville was a Frenchman. He came to America in the 1830s, and he studied America, and he came away impressed by our democracy, but really impressed by the fact that people came together to serve a greater cause through voluntary organizations. People said, you know, how best to help in a vibrant society, help a neighbor, and that is they formed what he called voluntary organizations to help a neighbor in need. The great strength of this country is the fact that there are millions of loving souls in America who are willing to reach out to somebody in need. I always say government can't love. It's just not a loving organization. There are people who work for government who have love in their heart, but government itself is not loving. It ought to be law and justice. The judgment government ought to be constantly thinking about ways to rally what I call the armies of compassion, so that light can get into the dark corners of our country, so that people who have heard the call to love a neighbor are empowered to do so and encouraged to do so. One of the most important and interesting domestic initiatives, which I agree is great and interesting philosophical debate, is to allow faith-based programs and community-based programs to access federal money in order to achieve the results we all want. Like, for example, if you're trying to encourage people to quit drinking, doesn't it make sense to give somebody an alternative? You can maybe go to a government or counselor. Or how about somebody who calls upon a higher being to help you quit drinking? All I care about is the results. And the government ought to be... So the answer, that's a long answer. In other words, my last answer, because you're paying me a lot of money, or probably... I'm not going to argue about my salary. But I got to get back to work. I do want to thank you for your interest. I hope you can tell I understand the importance of making sure America is entrepreneurial head. You know, one of the things that I love when I travel the world is that you get a sense for, you know, country by asking questions. One of the things about our country is it's a place where you start with zero. You start with a dream. And a good idea, in this case a good mom and dad, and take risk and realize your dream, and it's really important we keep it that way forever. America has got to be a place where dreamers can realize their dreams. And I love being in the midst of dreamers. Thanks for letting me come by. God bless you all.